objective was for this session, which is session 5, early clinical trials. In this session, as you see in your agenda program book, we're going to discuss extensively about how to design your early clinical trials to testing for cancer vaccine and adoptive T-cell immunotherapy, patient selections, evaluations, also at the end, we'll have a panel discussion session to discuss each of the issues as listed. So the format is that we have an elite team of presenters, Dr. Richard Sam from NCI. We have Dr. Craig Smigloff from University of Virginia. We have Dr. Holden Baker from BD Science, and we have Dr. Warwick Kielhoff from Charité Berlin to present each talk. Follow that, we'll have a panel discussion with panel discussion questions. The topics on the slide, we'll invite each of you to participate in that dialogue discussion. Now I'm going to turn to my co-chair, Dr. Kielhoff.
Thanks very much, Kate. I'm not going to make it a big introduction, but I will detail some of the dreams and hopes we would have in the organizing committee when planning the session later side to my own talk. So what I want to do is first call on Richard Simon, who is the chief of biometric research grants at the NCI here, to give his talk on clinical trial design and specific consideration for therapeutic cancer.
Thank you very much. Let me make sure I know how to advance the slides. I guess this button here that says slide.
This handheld thing.
Okay. Great. Thanks. Okay. Would like to draw your attention to the URL for my website. I may have to rush through some of the slides, but I will post the PowerPoint presentation on that website in the technical report section and talk section, and there are other related things that may be of interest to you. We're going to focus in this session on early clinical development, and I think that there's a lot to talk about in terms of early clinical development. I think most of the principles for phase three pivotal trials apply equally well to vaccines as they do to small molecules. Basically, the principles being to have a randomized control group, an appropriate control group, and some endpoint reflecting clinical benefit. I think most of the differences involving the clinical development of vaccines involve early the pre-pivotal trial stage. I think the one thing that's different at the pivotal trial stage is that the regimen that may be the experimental regimen to be evaluated relative to the control may more likely be a regimen containing several components. And it is essentially a combination regimen, and so there are regulatory issues of approving all of the components of that combination, where in the pivotal trial you may try to show that regimen is effective for a defined population of patients relative to some standard therapy. And you don't really want to have to start showing that all components of that regimen are necessary. If you have to do that, you're probably talking about an order of magnitude larger trial. But what you really want to be able to do is to show that you come up with a regimen which is effective with regard to clinical benefit, clinical utility for relative to an appropriate control for a defined population of patients. But there certainly are many differences between vaccines and chemotherapeutic agents in terms of the clinical development process that have implications for the early clinical trial process. Now, the basic objective, what are the basic objectives of phase two trials? Sometimes I think we tend to confuse the objectives of phase two and the objectives of phase three and get into trouble because we're not thinking really what the objectives are. The objectives, I would say, of phase two trials are, one, to determine whether some regimen is sufficiently promising to warrant doing a pivotal trial, to determine whether that regimen has a level of biological activity that's likely to translate into clinical benefit, and in some cases, we may not actually have markers of clinical benefit that we believe in well enough to use them, and we may just have to go ahead and do the phase three trial rather than spending years and years doing essentially uninterpretable phase two trials. So that's sometimes an issue. Another basic objective is to optimize the regimen. That's particularly important for immunotherapies and vaccine trials because there are a lot of components and a lot of options for how you put select components and put them together that need to be often, sometimes those questions can be addressed somewhat in terms of experimental models, but some of them need to be developed, need to be assessed.
Professor, we just need to pause for one quick second.
Okay. So some of those optimizations need to take place in the clinical setting, and usually the phase two development phase is where that needs to happen. And third, really to identify the right population of patients to include in the phase three trial. This is a real focus now with small molecule development. I mean, I think there's now a good recognition of the fact, particularly with molecularly targeted therapies, that if we do things the old way of treating broad population of patients, we're going to come up with a lot of false negative studies just because these drugs are going to, many of them will be effective, but for a subset of patients. And if we do broad studies in unselected patients, the benefits for the subsets are going to be washed away by the lack of benefit for the rest of the patients. And so the real way to effective clinical development is to, during the phase two development period, or even preclinically and based on the molecular target of the drug, is to identify what subset of patients are most likely to benefit from that, and then to focus the pivotal trial on that subset. That way you wind up doing a pivotal trial that's smaller than traditional, the case, and more likely to have actually a substantial treatment effect that will be clearly apparent in the pivotal trial. Now, some of the differences between therapeutic vaccines and chemotherapeutic agents. Many vaccines really are not likely to cause life-threatening or serious toxicity, and so that creates a different sort of environment for what kinds of phase one trials need to be done. And certainly if there's not going to be a dose-limiting toxicity, then that is going to influence how you're going to do your phase one trials, since those designs are traditionally based on escalating until you get a maximum tolerated dose based on dose-limiting toxicity. The issue is whether your target population for the pivotal trial may be in an adjuvant situation, and so then the question is, well, in your early development, do you want to do it in a traditional way for patients who have measurable tumor and use objective tumor response as your endpoint? in a traditional sort of way, using traditional kinds of early designs, or if you're going to do something other than that, then you have to think about, well, rethink the issue of what kind of clinical trial designs to use. And as I mentioned before, the vaccine strategies often combine multiple agents and components, and we need some efficient way of doing that optimization. I don't think I'm going to harp too much on the safety sort of issues. I will say a little bit, but that traditional dose escalation trials, in other words, if you're dealing with a regimen that is not likely to have dose-limiting toxicity, then you need to do something else. And a lot of times there's people talk about finding the optimal biological dose. Well, the traditional sort of clinical trial designs are really not oriented. They were not developed 3 patients per dose level, potentially escalated to 6 patients, keep escalating until you get dose-limiting toxicity. Those kind of designs obviously are not designed either for finding a minimal active dose, or certainly not for finding an optimal biological dose. And one can say, well, if I want a minimal active dose, and suppose I want a dose in which, with regard to some kind of immunological response, I want to know a dose at which at least 20% of the patients will have that immunological response. Well, if you have 0 out of 11, then you can conclude with, you know, fairly good probability that that dose is not going to give at least a 20% figure. And as your target for what percent of the patients should have the response goes up, then your number of patients you need to see at that dose goes down. But I'm just really trying to make the point here that if that's your objective, then you need to rethink. You can't just automatically use the traditional kind of design. Now, is it really appropriate to sort of try to find the optimum biological dose? That's a very ambitious objective. I guess I would take the position that it's often not feasible and perhaps not necessary. It does require large sample sizes. I think there's not abundant evidence that immunogenicity increases after a maximum for many kinds of immunotherapies. And therefore, you may not have to be too worried about being too high in the dose. And often there's uncertain relevance of the immunogenicity measures anyway. So devoting a long, long time trying to find the optimal biological dose may not be the efficient way to structure the development process. Well, let's focus on issues of phase 2 endpoints. Again, I think I want to try to be clear here that the purpose of phase 2 is to achieve those objectives I showed previously. It's not to show that there's clinical utility of the therapy. That's what I would say is the purpose of the phase 3 trial. The purpose of the phase 2 trial is to do things like optimizing the regimen, selecting the target population for the pivotal trial, and seeing whether things are promising enough that to go on to doing a pivotal trial. So the 3 kinds of endpoints that are often talked about are immunologic endpoints. Sometimes I hear people talking about it's not a validated endpoint. I think it's sort of inappropriate to expect it to be a validated endpoint. Validating an endpoint, any kind of a endpoint, is a valid surrogate for clinical benefit. To do that properly is a very ambitious goal, which actually requires phase 3 randomized trials in which you show that the treatment differences with regard to the endpoint you want to validate are sort of concordant with the treatment differences in the clinical measures. So really, I think if you're using immunologic endpoints in phase 2, it's because you believe those endpoints may be necessary but not sufficient for clinical benefit. And so you're going to try to optimize the regimen or see whether the regimen is at least promising enough, at least showing those effects, with the understanding that even if it does show those effects, it may not show clinical utility. But I think usually talking about, well, it's not a validated endpoint is sort of misplaced criticism. It's not going to be a validated endpoint. That's I think, an inappropriate objective. So I think it is often a reasonable endpoint for optimizing the components of a regimen. But as has been debated many times, is if that's all you see in your phase two and you don't have any sort of a clinical effects that you're seeing, tumor shrinkage or delaying time to progression, then whether or not that's promising enough to go forward in doing a pivotal trial, I think is a subjective judgment. It's a resource judgment. The pivotal trial is the trial that's actually going to give the answer. It's just a question of whether one can justify doing the phase three trial with that regimen if you don't see the clinical evidence in phase two. I'd like to distinguish that from, well, anyway, let's just leave it at that. Tumor shrinkage is in many ways the easiest endpoint to use for reasons I'll sort of get into, I think, in the next slide. The issue comes up is if your target population for the pivotal trial is an adjuvant disease situation, then whether or not one should whether or not it's appropriate whether you think you need to see traditional objective tumor response in patients with measurable disease or not, I think is also a subjective issue. Time till tumor progression on patients who may have no evident disease can, I think, be a good endpoint because you wind up treating patients with less disease on board. However, it's a more difficult endpoint to deal with because it generally requires some kind of control group. If a tumor shrinks, we usually believe it's not shrinking spontaneously, but so we can use tumor shrinkage sort of in single-arm trials as we've traditionally done with cytotoxics. If you're using time till tumor progression as your endpoint, generally you're going to have to say, well, is this time longer compared to what we would have seen if we hadn't used the vaccine? And so that generally requires a control group, and usually, unless that's a randomized control group, it's going to be very difficult to interpret that study. So single-arm evaluation in phase two is adequate if you're talking about objective tumor response of a vaccine alone. Of course, if you're talking about an immunologic, endpoint, and you're talking about change between pre-treatment and post-treatment levels of that endpoint, those things can be evaluated without a control group. But usually you need a control group if you're going to interpret objective tumor response of a standard of, say, chemotherapy plus a vaccine, because otherwise how will you know whether the vaccine played any role in that, unless you have previous data that really pins down that you would not have expected any objective responses from the chemotherapy alone. If that's the case, or objective response comparing different vaccine regimens to sort of compare different regimens, trying to optimize regimens where one institution is using one regimen and another institution is using another regimen, and that kind of data can be difficult to interpret because of difference in patient populations and difference in response assessment. Or progression-free survival of the vaccine alone or vaccine plus standard therapy, as I indicated. I think those are best done in randomized studies. There was a discussion yesterday of a trial of that type, and there was some controversy as to whether that trial was positive or not positive, promising or not sufficiently promising, because the results, the differences weren't statistically significant. But at least it was a randomized trial, and the data was, I believe, interpretable. Now, I don't want to spend too much time. I was just going to have a slide going over the traditional optimal single-arm, two-stage design that I published many years ago and is sort of widely used, and we actually have software for generating those kind of designs on my website. I think I will skip the details here. That can be used even without, when you're not talking about objective tumor response. It can, sometimes people try to use that when they define some kind of a immunologic response, that it has to, you know, something has to change by a certain percentage, and we'll call that a response. And the advantage of that is sort of it permits you to say whether a particular patient has experienced the response. It's not necessarily the best way to evaluate the entire phase two trial, though. It's almost better to not define response, but to just look the raw data of changes between pre-treatment, post-treatment levels for the group of patients treated as a whole, and to assess that you are seeing some effects. I do want to talk a little bit about different kinds of randomized phase two designs. One kind would be where you have a bunch of regimens, a bunch of immunotherapy regimens that may differ with regard to the adjuvants that they use, or the antigens that they use, or in other ways. And so one kind of a randomized phase two actually doesn't have a control arm. It doesn't have, say, a no immunotherapy control. It's just a bunch of different versions of an immunotherapy. And the objective really then is to select a regimen for further development. And these kinds of designs, actually, you can actually do this kind of thing and in other words, you can define an objective. Traditionally, with a phase two trial, the objective is to categorize a particular regimen as either being likely to have a response rate of above a certain level or likely to have it below that certain level, with a type 1 and type 2 sort of error probabilities. So to make an inference about the particular regimen. And if you think about these phase two designs, if you have multiple arms for the multiple regimens, you can design them so that it's just really there's no comparison involved, but you're making a separate inference on each regimen. And if your traditional phase two design would have required maybe 25 patients, then this would be 25 times the number of arms you have. But in some cases, you actually can define a different sort of objective. You can say, we really don't want to make conclusions necessarily about each regimen. We just want to select the regimen that is looking best for further development. And you say, well, if one of them actually is superior, we want to have a high probability of selecting it. But if they're equivalent, then we don't care which one we select. Now, in many cases, that's not an adequate objective, particularly if the different regimens differ very much in toxicity or cost or other aspects, then you may not be indifferent about which is selected. And in many cases, you're not indifferent. But if you take that as your objective, you actually can design these kinds of trials with relatively small total sample sizes relative to the number of regimens you study. And for example, if you say, well, we want a randomized selection design to select the most promising regimen for further evaluation, we want a 90% probability of selecting the best regimen if its mean response is at least, and in this case, a response not meaning respond, non-response. I just mean it, the difference between the post-treatment level and the pre-treatment level of, say, some immunologic endpoint is at least delta standard deviations above the next best regimen. And I won't go into details here. I really just want to make the qualitative statement that these kind of designs can get by with smaller total sample sizes. If you're looking for relatively substantial differences among the regimens, and if you're really only interested in selecting the best, if one actually is better than the other, and you don't care which you select otherwise, then this can be a very efficient approach. And it doesn't have to be, it can be done, that kind of an approach can be done with a traditional sort of binary response measure, or it can even be done with sort of a time to progression endpoint. As I mentioned before, with a time to progression endpoint, it's really difficult to evaluate without randomized groups to compare. And so one approach, so here we talk about, say, a randomized phase two design comparing some regimen to an appropriate control. And sometimes to do what makes this a phase two design rather than a pivotal phase three design? Well, two things. Sometimes you're using the endpoint of, say, time to progression may not be for that disease an endpoint approvable of the regimen. In other words, maybe survival for that disease is really the appropriate endpoint for a pivotal trial, but time to progression may be a perfectly good endpoint for phase two development. And the other thing that sometimes makes it a phase two design rather than a phase three design is that you can actually design it, whereas for phase three designs using a type 1 error of 5% is sort of industry standard and is very widely accepted. For a phase two design, you don't have to be that stringent, as was the case yesterday. You can interpret it as sort of a positive signal and worth going forward. And if you do make your threshold somewhat greater than 0.05, it does reduce the sample size somewhat. It does make the results a little bit more difficult to interpret, but that is one approach to sort of a phase two development. And the one other design I wanted to mention is a factorial design using, say, progression-free survival. Suppose you have two antigens you're interested in, two adjuvants, and you can then do a four-arm randomized, say, phase two design with, say, time to progression as your endpoint. But when you analyze it, and when you size it, you don't really size it as a four-arm trial. You say, well, when I'm evaluating the antigens, I'm going to pool over the different adjuvants. So I have four arms. One arm has patients get antigen A and adjuvant A, and the other arm patients get antigen A and adjuvant B. Third arm patients get antigen B and adjuvant A, and the fourth arm patients get antigen B and adjuvant B. But when I go to evaluate, say, antigen A versus antigen B, I sort of pool over the two adjuvants. And so really in sizing it, I size it as a two-arm trial. And you do make the assumption that the relative efficacy of the antigens is sort of independent of which adjuvant is using, and the relative efficacy of the two adjuvants are sort of independent of which antigens you're using, which may or may not be appropriate depending upon the circumstance. But in some cases, this can be a very efficient way of designing even phase two trials. And I guess the last trial I wanted to mention is what I call a seamless phase two and phase three, where you say, well, you know, really, to start doing randomized phase two trials, it entails more patients than I am used to, and if I do that, maybe I ought to just go ahead and do the pivotal trial. So the idea of the seamless phase two, phase three is that you initiate the pivotal trial, but you do an early interim analysis, in which case you analyze the early results. So maybe your pivotal trial is analyzed with regard to survival. That will be your ultimate endpoint. And your interim analysis is done with regard to progression-free survival. And if you get a treatment difference, say your treatment regimen, say versus your control, if you don't get a promising result with regard to progression-free survival, then basically you throw in the towel and you discontinue accrual and you say it's a failed trial, negative trial. If you do get a promising results with regard to progression-free survival, then you continue accrual and see it through to the end as a pivotal trial, and at the end you analyze it as a pivotal trial with regard to, say, your survival endpoint, if that's what you're using. And this can be done with things other than, it may be that progression-free survival is your pivotal trial endpoint and your phase two endpoint is something else, some measure of immunological response. So the concept is somewhat flexible, but the idea is, the idea is to sort of make the two seamless and to take the point of view that really to validate, let's not spend years trying to validate an endpoint as a surrogate for a clinical benefit. Let's just use that endpoint in a phase two way, we can achieve great efficiency even if it's not validated. If we believe that it's a necessary but not sufficient endpoint for achieving a clinical benefit, that we have to influence that shorter term end, that is a immunological endpoint, then we can use that sort of as a phase two endpoint, even in this seamless phase two, phase three trial. That kind of idea can be generalized, is that during the initial portions of the trial, you can actually have more than one vaccine arm. And at that interim analysis, you can then, suppose you have two vaccine arms and one control arm, and you do this seamless approach, and at your early interim analysis, you then select the vaccine arm that's looking best with regard to your phase two endpoint, and then you continue accrual with just that arm and the control arm. If neither one of those vaccine regimens are looking good, then you discontinue the trial in its entirety. The only adjustment really here is that at the end you will have to use a significance level of something like 0.025 instead of 0.05 to take into account that you actually had you really had two experimental arms, each of which you could have potentially compared to the control. And with that adjustment, you can get this kind of flexibility. So in summary, I would say dose-ranging safety trials are often not appropriate in vaccine studies. Dose-ranging trials to establish an optimal dose are often not realistic. Optimization of vaccine regimen by comparing results of single-arm studies using immunologic response is problematic. Randomized screening studies can be used to efficiently optimize immunogenicity. And finally, that effective regimen selection for further study is different than full evaluation of each regimen and may involve many fewer patients per regimen than is conventional. I included one slide at the end here containing some citations. So again, if you, I will make this PowerPoint available on my website. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rick, for this excellent overview. We will limit the discussion to technical direct questions to Rick, and we will have the 1 hour panel discussion afterwards. So who wants to ask a question?
And prior alongside the complications, in phase one, you don't put the same patient on at different dose levels because of the fear of human toxicity. What about the biologic trials? There's a little fear of that, particularly the vaccine trials, putting the same patient on at multiple dose levels to have more machine design.
Well, actually, I published a paper with some of my colleagues of a design called the accelerated titration design that was for cytotoxics, and that did. This was published in JNCI several years ago, and it has been used. And it did permit intrapatient dose escalation. We actually analyzed a lot of data from clinical trials to see whether how frequent cumulative toxicity was a problem. And we found that it was not that much of a problem for many of the cytotoxics. So I guess I'm just saying that even for cytotoxic trials, there are designs there, such as the accelerated titration design, that do permit intrapatient dose escalation. And I think I would think that given that toxicity in general will be less of a consideration, in some cases you'll have to do the dose escalation anyway, but I think being able to do it within a patient would be appropriate and efficient.
Could you expand a little bit on your suggestion, the possibility of an interim analysis of PFS based on 50% accrual versus based on a number of events occurring, with the idea, I'm just curious about the strength of the evidence that you might get from that approach that you just mentioned.
I probably don't have enough time right now to answer that fully. We could talk about it offline. I think it's an important question, and exactly how you time that and what sort of significance level you use, there's a lot of dimensions to it, because one of the things, if you're doing a seamless phase two, phase three, if you actually do get a significant result with your, say, PFS endpoint, that could potentially be a basis of a claim for accelerated approval, and because you actually then do have a phase three trial ongoing, and so it's actually probably a stronger claim basis for accelerated approval than many of the accelerated approvals that the FDA has made. But I think in general, exactly how you usually when you have event studies, you sort of time it based on events rather than number of patients. But we could talk about it in more detail.
Okay, I think we need to move on. We have time for the panel discussion. The next speaker is Paul Michael from the Education by the Science. And his title is Measure of Teacher Responsibility to School Master.
Discuss the latest lecture for it.
Okay.
Limited to the. Yeah. It is extremely important. It is an excellent suggestion. But it's
that was fine. Yeah, it was too complicated.
So I'll start with the technical portion. We'll just talk about the things that we can measure, some of the different assays that are out there, and some work we've done to compare them, and also to standardize and begin to do some QA and proficiency training in some of the assays. And then I'll give you some examples, a little bit of scientific data using these quality assays and looking at tumor responses, or actually tumor antigen responses in patients, what's there to begin with before you begin those. So if we consider the different things that are out there in terms of immunological functions, from cellular immunity side, we begin really with the interaction of APCs and T cells, and from there generate some early responses, the most commonly measured being cytokines. We can also measure cytotoxicity by various kinds of assays now. And then in a little bit longer term scale, we can measure things like proliferation and apoptosis. But it's really these early events that are probably easiest and most direct to measure, and perhaps most quantitative as well. And so if you consider the kinds of assays that are out there for these different readouts, the traditional assays have usually been done in bulk cultures. And the older ones tend to be radioactive assays like chromium release and proliferation by thymidine incorporation. We tend to try to get away from those as much as possible for reasons that we can discuss. But there are, of course, non-radioactive bulk culture assays as well, including ELISAs for cytokine secretion, and now some flow-based assays, flow cytometry-based assays that are for cytokine secretion by capturing more beads. But I would say probably the most promising and interesting newer assays are those that are single cell assays. In other words, they interrogate cells one by one and allow you to look at their specificity or their function. The specificity assays being the peptide tetramer or other kinds of multimers that are available, and the functional assays being things like ELISpa and these other assays, which really are all kind of variations on a flow cytometry-based functional assay for T cells. So I'm going to focus probably most on intracellular cytokine staining, but there are other kinds of assays that are looking at related functions, including proliferative assays that you can also do by flow cytometry. Here in this slide, I just want to highlight what some of these readouts in